Chapter 4. Planet Smell. You have more in common with your dog than you might think. Isla is a tiny cat, a perfect cat, who sleeps soft and silky on my chest every night. Until I brought her inside 3 years ago, she lived in the barn, keeping the mice out of the grain, sleeping curled up on top of my woolly sheep on cold winter nights. One spring, the shearer was amazed to find felt instead of wool on one of the ewe's backs. Sheep like old Martha don't usually turn their own wool into felt, but the warmth and moisture from Isla's snoozing body had matted Martha's wool into a circle of felt. Pretty endearing, coming home on a snowy winter evening to see your cat curled up on top of your favorite ewe, both bedecked with snowflakes like dime store Christmas trees. But now Isla had been missing for 3 days. I returned home from a business trip on the third day of her absence and combed the farm, calling and looking everywhere. Late that night, searching by the barn, I heard one soft meow. Or was it? So quiet, never repeated. It could have been Isla, or just a bird in the woods settling into a cozy roost. I returned to the house for the flashlight, and spent another hour peering into the messy piles of farm debris that grow like algae in southern Wisconsin barns. Nothing. Early the next morning, I searched again. This time, I was sure the quiet call I heard was Isla. Again, she meowed just once, but I heard it clearly this time, and I knew that she was in the barn, and I knew that if I didn't find her, she'd die. And I knew that I'd already looked and looked, and I knew that my chances of finding her in that old barn were lousy. I looked a few more minutes and then sat down and cried. I had already looked for hours. I knew that injured cats usually hole up in a safe place and stay there. They rarely meow, even when their owners call, abiding by some primal desire to hide when hurt. My chances of finding her in the chaos of my old barn were nil. This is not just a simple space, this barn. This is the top story of a huge old dairy barn with endless passageways through the floorboards, 400 bales of hay, and head-high piles of fence posts and wire and moldy siding. That cold, still morning, I was sure that I'd never be able to find Isla, and that my sweet, tiny cat was dying somewhere within a few feet of me. But Isla and I weren't alone in the barn. My border collie, Pip, was in the barn with me, sniffing as always around the pigeon poop and fox tracks. Pip has not read the books on border collies. She wags her tail to sheep, like Babe without the secret code, and couldn't move a stubborn ewe if her life depended on it. Worthless on sheep, Pip is worth her weight in gold as an applied animal behaviorist dog, having rehabilitated more than 100 dogs from their fear-induced aggression toward other dogs. Pip loves food, tennis balls, and other dogs, in that order. Next, she loves using her nose, reading the world around her like a newspaper written in scent. While I was crying, I remember saying, "Oh, Pippi, where's Isla? I can't find Isla." I was pouring my heart out to her, as so many of us dog owners do, with no expectation that she'd join the search. A few minutes later, I heard a noise and looked up to see Pip standing on top of a mound of hay bales, stacked 8 feet high and filling up half the barn. She had her nose jammed between two bales and was digging and whining. She'd never done that before, and she's never done it since. It had to be Isla. I must have slung 50 bales of hay before I found her, directly beneath where Pip had been digging, a 7-pound lump of starved, dehydrated cat with a leg and shoulder so swollen I didn't even recognize them at first for what they were. She looked dead. The vet said she would have been in a few hours. She had a bad bite to the shoulder that had abscessed, and the infection raged while she hid in the hay bales, slowly dying. Isla is fine now. She's retired to the house where she can curl up on warm, sheep-like laps. She visits the barn on occasion, but now prefers her naps to be inside, close to the heating duct. Last month, I presented her with a mouse caught but not killed in a trap. She turned and walked away. Apparently, she is taking her retirement seriously. Pip saved Isla's life, and she did it with her nose. I have a nose, too. It works just fine. The rich, musky smell of wild plums hit me like a soft pillow last night as I walked through the valley. I go to sleep to lavender and bring eucalyptus on my business trips to mask the odors of bad motel rooms. I can smell cat urine on a carpet as well as anyone in the world, a required skill for an applied animal behaviorist. But it never occurred to me to use my nose to find Isla. Of course, my nose doesn't work as well as Pip's, but did I even consider trying to use it? No. I looked. I listened. Pip smelled. I'm a human. She's a dog. The nose knows. We all know how good dogs are with their noses. We see bomb-sniffing dogs in airports and hear about bloodhounds who trail lost children through the woods. We watch our dogs sniff under other dogs' tails and wonder what in the world they're learning about one another. What we don't know is how very good our own noses are. Our abilities may pale compared to that of a beagle, who I affectionately call the nose with paws, but scent is profoundly important to us humans. We just don't seem to be aware of it most of the time. As described in A Natural History of the Senses by Diane Ackerman, research on humans' ability to smell is nothing less than astounding. People can tell whether a particular piece of clothing was worn by a man or woman just by sniffing it, even when they say they can't. Mothers can correctly identify the smell of their own infants, even when they say they're just guessing. Babies can tell by smell when their own mothers enter the room. Mothers can pick out t-shirts worn by their own children among those worn by others. Women can identify the maturity of a person just by his or her scent, distinguishing accurately among an infant, a child, an adolescent, or an adult. Just like dogs, we can tell if a scent comes from a male or female. Helen Keller, left blind and deaf by scarlet fever as an infant, claimed that she could tell what people had been doing just by their smell, that odors of wood or the kitchen clung to them long after they moved into a different area. The sense of smell mediates more of our behavior than we ever imagined. Women who live in close proximity to one another begin to menstruate in synchrony, all because of smells of which they're not even aware. Men who are in intimate relationships with women have faster growing facial hair than men who aren't. And girls who grow up around men enter puberty sooner than girls who do not. The sense of smell is even an important component of sexual pleasure. Fully half of the people who have lost their sense of smell as adults report a decrease in sexual interest. Research on reproductive pheromones, which often can't be consciously detected at all, even if you try, has led to the use of a pheromone called alpha-androstenol in perfume. Not only does it attract members of the opposite sex, both in our species and in pigs, do be careful on a hog farm, but men rate photographs of women as more attractive if it's in the air, and women are more likely to initiate interactions if in its presence. Although scent has a profound effect on our behavior, much of our response to smell is not within the realm of conscious thought. We humans may be the animal masters of self-awareness and consciousness, but our dogs have it all over us when it comes to the awareness of smells. It's even difficult to talk about smell. Try describing a scent to someone who's never smelled it. Ackerman, in A Natural History of the Senses, calls smell the mute sense, the one without words. We don't even acknowledge the lack of smell. We have labels for people who can't hear or can't see, but we have no commonly known term for someone who can't smell. Living without a sense of smell is no small matter. It's dangerous, for one thing. Imagine not being able to smell smoke or gas or rotten food. And yet we never talk about people with a smell disability, as if it wasn't worth our attention. Even many scientists, especially those who study mammals, pay little attention to the sense of smell. The Human Brain, published by the BBC in conjunction with its popular television series, has a section on memory, language, vision, movement, fear, and consciousness, but nothing on the sense of smell. The Biology of Mind by M. Derek Bounds, a brilliant book about mind and consciousness, has only one paragraph on olfaction, and that's in the section on memory. I spent hours looking in the indexes of my library of books on primate and human behavior. Very few of them had any reference at all to scent or smell or olfaction. The biggest exception is in the insect literature, where there is a tremendous amount of research on airborne signals called pheromones that drive a lot of insects' behavior. Perhaps it is easier for us to associate a primitive sense like smell with animals that we see as far removed from us. Visual as primates are, we have a long list of impressive responses to different scents. Cotton-top tamarin females respond to the scent of ovulating unfamiliar females by soliciting sex with their partners. The scent of her mother is enough to inhibit a mature, mated female cotton-top tamarin from ovulating, even if she's alone with her new boyfriend. In a recent study, squirrel monkeys were found to have surprising olfactory abilities and were able to discriminate some scents better than rats or dogs. Many primates mark their territories by scent marking. Squirrel monkeys even urinate on their own feet, spreading it over their body in a kind of bath in reverse in order to leave a sticky scent trail behind them wherever they go. Several primates have specialized scent structures in their chests, throats, and wrists, where we humans put perfume on ourselves. The primates with which I worked, cotton-top tamarins and pygmy marmosets, scent marked the branches in their cages, using smells to communicate to their own family and other troops housed down the hall that they could hear but not see. The bottom line is that all primates use the sense of smell a lot, but we humans don't think about it much. Over the years, I've occasionally succumbed to curiosity and got down on my hands and knees and sniffed where my pack of dogs were sucking air like vacuum cleaners. A few times I wasn't able to smell a thing, but most often I'm impressed with some rich, thick scent that smells markedly different than the ground a few inches away. My dogs appear to enjoy my behavior more than I do, increasing their sniffing and tail wagging and licking one another and me as if something notable had happened. Perhaps it had. Perhaps it's no small thing when we humans become more consciously aware of smells than we usually are. Just writing this chapter has had an influence on how I perceive the world. I was about to say, see the world, and was struck by yet another example of how visual we are. I consulted my internal thesaurus, not wanting to limit the concept to vision, and came up with view. Whoops, visual again. See? Oh, good grief. It is a big deal when we try to expand our sensory awareness. After just an hour of research for this chapter, I began sniffing my way around the house like some crazed rabbit, nose twitching, eyes squinted shut, little short snuffle sounds following me around like a drumbeat. I learned a lot. First of all, my house is even dirtier than I thought. A lot of things smell dusty or moldy, although the air in the house smells fresh and fine. But beyond that depressing discovery, there was an entire world just waiting for me to notice. Almost every object I sniffed had its own distinct smell. I never expected each book I sniffed to smell different from all the others, but it did. There were some trends. Older paperbacks smelled moldy, new hardcovers smelled woody, a sweatshirt only worn once and then over a t-shirt on a cool day smelled strongest under the armpits. My sheets still smelled like detergent. An old dry dog bone smelled dusty. The remote control for the TV smelled sharp, chemical. Try sniffing around your own house and yard. Keep in mind a few things that come naturally to dogs. First of all, you'll bring in more scent if you sniff in little short bursts rather than one long inhale. There's a reason that your dog sniffs in staccato notes. Sniff something with one long inhale, maybe for a second or so, and then sniff the same object with 4 to 6 quick sniffs within the same time frame. Often you'll smell much more with short, quick sniffs. Don't sniff too hard. Short, soft sniffs are all that's needed. Second, don't hesitate to get your nose right on the object. As well as dogs can perceive smells, They don't hesitate to sink their noses deep into whatever it is that they're interested in. Don't be shy. Do be careful if you have serious allergies. I'd hate for your experiment to turn into an asthma attack. And be aware of what's called olfactory adaptation. We all know about it. It's the reason that you can sample only so many perfumes at one time. Your olfactory system has to reset itself once it's been satiated. And it simply can't discern different smells effectively once it's been swamped with a number of them already. So, sniff a few objects and then give your system some time to recover before moving on. The biggest surprise to me was when I smelled the fur on the top of my dog's necks. I expected that they would smell a bit different, each one of them, but I was so shocked by how very different they smelled that my head jerked up like an animal in a Gary Larson cartoon. Pip, having recently rolled and subsequently bathed, still smelled like shampoo. Luke smelled almost astringent, while Lassie had a softer, fruitier smell. Tulip, the sheep guarding Great Pyrenees, gets bathed more on the schedule of a guard dog and less on that of a house dog. As a result, her smell is very strong, distinctive, and sort of bittersweet. It's not unpleasant to me, but it'll never sell as a perfume. The least amount of smell was on Isla, the cat that Pip sniffed out beneath the hay. I could barely smell her at all. The Alien Planet of Smell. As a friend and I were getting ready to go on a bike ride, I was busy shutting windows, locking doors, and checking for food left out on the counters. Pip may stand big-eyed at the window when I drive away, but she's not distressed about my leaving. Mostly, she's watching to be sure that I'm really gone so she can shop for edibles. On the way out, I discover a loaf of good, chewy bread on the counter, so I went to put it inside a cupboard. "Oh, I'm sorry," said my friend. "I didn't put it away because I didn't think the dogs could smell it. It's wrapped in plastic." My friend wasn't used to living with noses that put intelligence agencies to shame. Titanium wrapping wouldn't deter the nose of Pip when she's on the hunt for food. If I'm ever buried in an avalanche, please let Pip be close by, above the snow and able to use her nose. She'd find me, I know, unless someone had dropped a Twinkie 20 yards away, in which case I'd suffocate while listening to Pip dig relentlessly through the snow for it. Dogs have about 220 million scent receptors, while humans can boast only about 5 million. That's why some have argued that dogs can smell 44 times better than humans. But scent reception isn't just about the number of neurons you have in your nose. As Stephen Budiansky points out in The Truth About Dogs, it also depends on what's being sniffed at the time. Dogs can detect some odors that humans can't notice until the scent is 50 times more concentrated. Other odors can be perceived by dogs at concentrations that need to be hundreds of times more intense for humans to perceive. Every species has particular odor combinations that it is better at perceiving, and the same is true with dogs. Dogs are designed as scent machines with mobile nostrils. Try to move yours to the right or left without moving your head. A special bony structure, the vomeronasal organ, which hangs on to large scent molecules like Velcro, and an olfactory bulb in their brain that is proportionately 4 times larger than ours. Dogs can detect human scent on a glass slide that has been touched just lightly, then left for 2 weeks outdoors or 4 weeks indoors. It's trivial for them to use smell to distinguish which stick you picked up and threw yesterday from all the other sticks lying in the yard. They can distinguish t-shirts worn by identical twins who ate different foods. Dogs are used all over the world to find buried landmines. There's simply no better method available, since mines are now mostly made of plastic and metal detectors are useless. Glenn Johnson, in his great book, Tracking Dog, Theory and Methods, describes his German Shepherd who detected 150 gas leaks along a 94-mile-long buried pipeline deep under wet clay. Johnson and his dog were the utility's last-ditch effort to find the leaks. They'd tried every technology available and come up with nothing else that worked. Cornell Medical Center is investigating the use of dogs as cancer detectors after a number of clients with cancer came in only because their dogs reacted as if they could detect something wrong. Stanley Coren, in How to Speak Dog, talks about a Shetland sheepdog named Trisha who kept worrying a mole on her owner's back. After Trisha tried to bite it off, the owner finally mentioned the mole to her physician, who identified it as a potentially fatal melanoma. Rin Tin Tin never looked so good. Even though we know how good dogs are with their noses, we know amazingly little about what they're really smelling. For example, we're not sure what the focus of tracking dogs is when they follow someone's footsteps. We do know that all humans shed minuscule particles of dead skin called rafts that follow us like smoke from a moving cigarette. We deposit odors on the ground with each stride that we take, and dogs don't need much of it to find us. About 1/4 billionth of a gram of sweat is left on the ground by the average man's foot with each step. That, believe it or not, is more than enough for a dog. But those are just some of the ingredients of the stew of smells that we all leave behind us. We crush vegetation, disturb the soil, and broadcast particles of hair, molecules from our aftershave, our deodorant, our clothes, and our shoes. The problem for dogs usually isn't finding the scent. It's sorting out the multitude of scents that are there already. Even the weather affects how much your dog can smell. Wet versus dry, cold versus warm, windy versus calm. All of these factors change the conditions every time your dog puts her nose down and attempts to follow a trail. To learn more about how your dog perceives the world, try enrolling your dog in a tracking class. In the class that I took, we novices bonded quickly, grinning over our clumsy efforts to manage the tracking line and guffawing over our initial obliviousness to the world of scent trailing. When we compared notes on our first attempts to set a track for our dogs by ourselves, we each had a similar, humbling story. After leashing our dog to a handy tree or pole, we had carefully walked forward to create a track, placing each foot with care and thoughtfulness. In the early stages of training a tracking dog, it's critical to give her one simple, clear track to follow, with no confusing cross tracks, so each footstep was carefully placed. In every other footprint, we added a nugget of food to reward our dogs for carefully following the scent of our steps. But at least once, when we novices got to the end of our carefully laid scent trail, each of us had sighed with pride in our accomplishment, and then cheerfully walked back to our dog by the shortest route. By doing so, we walked directly over the scent track that we had just finished laying, making mincemeat of the smells that we had so carefully deposited on the way out. It's a wonderful example of how rare it is for humans to think consciously about scent. My favorite part of class was watching how a breeze affected the dogs. A wind blowing from the left would push the scent over to the right of the trail. The dogs would waver back and forth, moving in a sinusoidal S-curve, trying to follow the molecules of scent as they moved through the air, losing them as they dispersed, and then turning back to the source, always searching out the highest concentration of whatever molecules it was that they were keyed onto. Scent is like a fog, a physical entity with its own physical integrity. Just like fog, scent settles in hollows, wafts through the air, and moves and flows in space, invisible to us, but clear as a bright light to our dogs. Scientists in Norway and Sweden were interested in whether dogs can tell the direction of travel of what they are tracking. Since we humans usually start them out at the beginning of a trail, they naturally go in that direction anyway. The researchers asked the question, if you start a dog out in the middle of a trail and give him no information about which way to go, will he choose to track in the direction of travel of whoever made the trail? Indeed he will, but only under some interesting conditions. If the trail consisted of discontinuous pools of odor, as footsteps are, the dog followed in the direction that the person walked. But if the track was left by something that always contacted the ground, like a bicycle tire or a sack dragged on the ground, the dog went both ways equally often. Possibly a continuous gradient didn't allow the dog enough difference between relative strengths to tell him the direction of travel. A similar effect was found in one of the T-shirt studies done on dogs. The T-shirts of identical twins couldn't be distinguished by the dogs unless the shirts were some distance apart. If they were side by side, they probably blended together, masking the differences and complicating the choice. It's difficult to know how to interpret a dog's response to scent trails, given how little we know about the information that dogs are gathering. Clearly, we need many more studies on the scent-related abilities of dogs. Right now, there are many aspects of a dog's life that we can only speculate about, given our primitive olfactory abilities and the dearth of research. For instance, it is common for house cats to attack their best feline friend after one cat has visited a vet clinic and picked up new scents. And I wonder if this could happen in dogs. Do recently bathed dogs smell bad to other dogs? Can bad doggy breath cause social isolation in dogs, just as in our species? Or since dogs love smells that disgust us, does bad breath smell good to dogs? I've often wondered what role scent had in the behavior of aggressive dogs. The most common type of dog-dog aggression that I see is dogs who growl, bark, and lunge as they pass by other dogs on a leash. But surprisingly often, owners come with dogs who, for all the world, look as if they're just dying to play with that cute little poodle across the street. Typically, the preliminaries go well. Dogs both take on friendly greeting postures, and then 2 or 3 seconds into the greeting, the dog in question explodes and attacks the other dog. Often, we've been able to eliminate common causes, like inadvertent owner cues, tension on the leash, holding the breath, rounding the mouth, or a reactive response from the other dog. I'm left wondering if smell is an important factor in at least some of these cases. Could the attacked dogs smell like another dog with which the aggressor once had trouble? Or perhaps the victim's dog's hormonal state elicits an aggressive reaction? Maybe they just smell bad. I took in a fearful little Australian shepherd who was so damaged that she lived with me for part of a summer. She was terrified of my then-husband, Patrick, who stood up to his full 6-foot-5-inch stature when she first entered the living room. She reacted in terror, bark lunging at him with pupils the size of pancakes, and never got over her fear of him. I could merely hold his keys up to her nose and she'd begin to growl as soon as she smelled them. Surely the memory of a smell that was linked with a bad experience could relate to dog-dog encounters, too. I had a client whose dog seemed to attack visitors rarely and randomly, greeting most people at the door like long-lost friends, but occasionally turning into a monster. She'd bitten several times, and her responsible family was desperately trying to protect their friends and yet not abandon their dog. We all worked hard trying to rehabilitate her, but we needed to find a pattern. What was it about some visitors that set her off? Or was it not the visitors themselves, but something else? We couldn't find a pattern in whom she attacked and whom she loved. It wasn't about any of the usual factors, not sex or height or facial hair or hats. We finally figured it out. It was pizza. It seems a pizza delivery boy had kicked her when she was about 6 months old, a highly impressionable age for a dog. And if you entered the house having eaten pizza, you were in trouble. We conditioned her to associate visitors smelling like pizza with wonderful things, like getting to eat the pizza. And she's been fine ever since. Can you tell me where the restroom is? I can't smell it anywhere. When we humans are out in public and need a restroom, we all behave consistently. First, we use our eyes, looking for the sign that says restroom or women or men. Failing that, we use sound. Excuse me, where's your restroom? But dogs don't look for a restroom, nor do they talk about it with whines, barks, or howls. They put their noses down and search it out by scent. That's why you have to eliminate any odor of urine or feces in the house if your dog has a housebreaking problem. Dogs who urinate or defecate in the house have a hard time resisting the chemical sign on your carpet that says, "Go here." Just because it's written in odor doesn't make it less compelling. Even dogs who were actually house-trained have pottied in the house because the dogs define house differently than their owners. We define house as bordered by walls, but most dogs seem to define house as where you spend your time, and therefore where the pack's scent is the strongest. Many of my clients' dogs only went in the back guest room, a place with none of the familiar odors of the family. In most of those cases, simply eliminating the odor of urine and then marking the area with a different scent can get the dog going in the right restroom again. Once the area is odor-free and clean, sit down on the carpet with your dog and a paperback and spend a little time there each day. In just a few days, that place will smell like a living room instead of a toilet to your pup. It also helps tremendously to give your dog a treat every time that she goes outside. Right after she goes, not after she trots back to the house. I'm always a bit surprised at how resistant so many owners are to doing this. Once our dogs are no longer puppies, we seem to have some sense of entitlement that grown-up dogs should go outside, because they should know better. But if they're going to the bathroom in the house, you can either get upset about it and put on a threat display as any agitated primate would, scaring the heck out of your dog in the process, or you can get over it and give him a treat for going outside. Trust me, the latter works a lot better. All smells all the time? Just as we often aren't able to share in the remarkable world of smells in which our dogs live, we are equally unaware of its limitations. It seems simplistic to point out that all dogs don't use their noses equally well, but sometimes we tend to lump them all together as wonder dogs and leave it at that. But their skills and abilities do vary, and both genetics and experience play important roles. Individuals of some breeds are more likely than others to be good with their noses. In John Paul Scott and John L. Fuller's Dog Behavior, The Genetic Basis, the researchers described putting untrained beagles, fox terriers, and Scotties in a one-acre field in which they'd released a mouse. It took the beagles about a minute to find the mouse, and the terriers 15 minutes. The Scotties never found it at all. But genetics isn't everything. Experience is as important in nose work as it is in any of our endeavors. Sometimes there's a multitude of rich smells, and it takes a lot of experience for a dog to sort through the miasma of competing scents. Sometimes the scent that he's following is so weak that it's barely perceptible, even to a dog. The same thing happens to us all the time, just usually with sound or vision. It happened to me in the sheep ranching country of Wyoming, where a ranch road is any area of the desert that has had tire tracks on it in the last 2 years. Both interstate highways and Wyoming ranch roads can be found by using your eyes, but interstates are a bit easier to follow, unless you grew up as a sheep herder. I drove 26 miles down one of these roads one late afternoon, and by the time I reached the end, actually, my truck and trailer fell apart about a mile from the ranch house, so I can't really say that I reached the end. My eyes were exhausted from trying to discriminate between bare patches caused by tire tracks and bare patches caused by anything else. Dogs have the same olfactory challenges sometimes, and it's only the committed and experienced ones that stay with it through thick and thin. By the way, this single-minded nature, a prized quality in tracking and trailing dogs, can make for a challenging pet. When beagles and bloodhounds put their noses down to the ground, I suspect that the rest of the world fades into oblivion. Think adolescent with headphones on, and you'll know what I mean. Remember when you were little and you imagined that adults had infinite power? Surely someone who could drive the car, open the juice container, and reach the sink could make it stop raining. I think that's the same expectation that we have with respect to our dogs and their ability to smell. Because they are so good at using their noses, we assume that they can smell anything, anytime. But dogs use other senses too. And the brains of both humans and dogs tend to amplify one sense at a time. Many an owner has been snapped at by her dog when she returned home with a new hairdo or a new coat. Surprised by the vision of an unfamiliar silhouette barging into the house, these dogs were using their eyes instead of their noses. Their noses may be remarkable, but they're not always switched on. Even if they want to, dogs can't smell anything unless volatile airborne particles float into their noses. Dogs may be able to smell a grain of cocaine in a warehouse full of coffee beans, but they can't smell anything at all unless they can come in physical contact with some of its airborne molecules. If your scent particles are being blown by the wind away from your dog, she can't smell you any better than your neighbor can. Difference in smell preferences. A fox used to raise her babies every year in a den behind the barn, but didn't return this spring. Her absence is probably due to an untimely death from mange. Last year, a mange epidemic swept the foxes, coyotes, and wolves of Wisconsin. Most likely, she was among the three foxes who, over the summer, slowly lost both weight and hair until they finally died, starving and bedraggled in my barn. The mange mites, of course, also came to the farm, ready to jump ship at the first possible opportunity for a live host. Tulip got it first, after trotting proudly out of the top of the barn with a limp fox carcass hanging from her jaws. Then Luke got it, badly. Some of his skin became completely bare of fur, starting at halfway up his tail and descending down his rump. He began to look like that cartoon of a guy bending over, pants too low. It's hard to look noble with an almost naked tail and a butt crack showing. I engaged in a cyclone of research on mange mites and a multitude of assorted treatments until I finally declared it beaten. It's no fun for anyone when dogs get sarcoptic mange, but imagine what it's like when your dogs are part of your profession. My dogs all work hard for our living. They are invaluable in dog-dog aggression cases, and they get the bulk of the attention at speeches and book signings. Yet, they and the farm were on quarantine for months. Even so, I have mixed feelings about my absent fox's disappearance. Certainly, I became conditioned last summer to worry that every time I saw a fox, it would bring mange back again. But before the epidemic, which comes and goes like most cycles of nature, I would glory in her presence. Every spring I watched her raise her kits between the road and a steep slope of woods just 50 yards from my barn. I loved her babies, who played on magical evenings on the front lawn, leapfrogging around the pink and white peony bushes. I loved hearing her cough bark, watching her trot purposefully across the county highway with food for her young early in the morning. But even before the mange struck, the fox had brought something with her that dampened my pleasure, a smell so strong and awful it could gag you. If she'd kept it to herself, it would have been one thing, but she didn't. She painstakingly scent-marked my farm every night, leaving neat little piles of fox poop on my front porch. The piles weren't the problem. My dogs were, because they threw themselves with passion onto her scat and ground it into their ruffs as if it were invaluable. If you haven't smelled a dog who's rolled in fox feces, your life is slightly better than mine. Because it's a horrible smell, skunky and repulsive, and it clings to dog fur like a burr. I would never pretend that I understand what is going on in the brain of my dogs when they're rolling in fox poop. And of course, it's not just fox feces that gets my dog's attention. To all dogs, the stinkier the smell, the more attractive the object, including dead fish, fresh sloppy cow pies, the more liquid the better, and partially dried squirrel bodies. Maggots are a plus, a value-added commodity in canine economics. It's impossible not to imagine that dogs enjoy themselves when they're rolling in slime. Their eyes begin to glaze, their mouths droop in a relaxed grin as they duck their shoulders and grind their backs into some foul, rotting mess. After satisfying themselves that they are properly anointed, they trot home with the high-headed, confident stride we might adopt when life is good and the day is ours. A myriad of theories try to explain why dogs roll in smelly things, but they're all just guesses. One of the best known is that dogs are putting their own scent on the resource to mark it as their own. I'm not sure about this, given that dogs scent mark resources all the time by urinating and defecating on or around them. Tulip, who grew up eating outside, still occasionally squats in place as she eats her last bite of dinner on the porch. Perhaps dogs roll on things that they might later want to put in their mouths, and so they roll on the object rather than urinate on it. I've seen so many dogs lick up urine that I'm skeptical, but open-minded, about this possibility. Others have suggested that, as predators, dogs are trying to camouflage their scent to prey animals by smelling like something else. I suspect this just makes them smell like a dog or wolf who rolled in something stinky. Besides, if I were a vulnerable prey animal and I smelled an 80-pound dead squirrel moving toward me, I'd probably start getting a little jumpy. But mostly, I'm not so fond of the camouflage of scent theory because of the behavior of prey animals themselves. Working border collies on sheep gives you a good idea of how animals, at least hoofed ones, pay attention to the world around them. Sheep, deer, and horses are highly visual, always looking for signs of predators. That's one of the reasons that they have eyes on the side of their head. It allows them to keep an eye out, even when their head is down to graze. Scent is no doubt important in predator detection in some species, but the sight of an approaching wolf surely would have a substantial effect on a deer herd, even if the wolf did smell like a dead rabbit. My favorite theory is what I call the guy with the gold chain hypothesis. It starts with how dogs and other canines make a living. Dogs and wolves aren't just hunters, they're scavengers, and scavengers can't be too picky about getting their meat refrigerator fresh. They eat what's available, and what's more, they want to live in a territory where there is lots of food available. Perhaps, it's been suggested, dogs roll in dead things or stinky poop as a way of advertising to other dogs, "Hey, look at me. I live in a high-rent district with an abundance of good things." This seems to me to be the most plausible theory. But perhaps there's something else. Maybe, just maybe, they also do it for the same reason we put on perfume. They like the smell. And just as we might put perfume on ourselves to attract others, we also put it on to please ourselves. Maybe it makes dogs smell good, both to themselves and to others. Stanley Coren proposed the same theory in his book, How to Speak Dog. I love the section in which Coren declares rolling in obnoxious smells, obnoxious at least to us, to be the equivalent of the same misbegotten sense of aesthetics that causes human beings to wear overloud and colorful Hawaiian shirts. It will help from now on when I'm bathing yet another slimy, greenish dog to imagine her in a fuchsia and orange flowered shirt, complete with baggy shorts and bad socks. But enough about dogs. What about us? We humans put alien smells onto our bodies too. We just like different ones. What must dogs think of a species that grinds up jelly from deer bellies, musk, a squishy liquid from sperm whales, ambergris, secretions from anal glands, civet, and the genitalia of plants, flowers are reproductive parts, pure and simple, to smear all over our bodies? We love this stuff as much as dogs love a good squirrel carcass. Perfume is a $5 billion a year industry. New scents are developed in secret research that is as carefully guarded as the development of biological warfare agents. That's why perfume and sweet-smelling products like bath oil are, appropriately enough, the ultimate generic gift of Christmas and birthdays. Almost everyone likes to smell good and to smell good things. We're very aware of that aspect of the world of smell. We notice if the air smells sweet and fresh or heavy and foul. Bad breath can poison a conversation and be a social nightmare for its producer. Some people can yearn for the scent of a lover or child as if hungry for life-sustaining food. Almost everything that we buy is scented, whether we notice it or not. Manufacturers know, for example, that good-smelling furniture polish is rated more effective than the exact same polish without an added scent. Our obsession with good smells isn't new. The athletes of ancient Crete rubbed themselves with scented oils before the early versions of the Olympic Games. Alexander the Great adored perfume and incense, as did all the men of ancient times. Syrians, Babylonians, Romans, and Egyptians all doted on the scent of flowers and sandalwood and saffron. Indeed, the first gift to the Christ child was incense. So although we ignore the sense of smell in much of our life, we share with dogs a lust for anointing ourselves with scents that make us and others feel good. What we don't share is what constitutes a good smell as opposed to a bad one. We're not the only ones who are appalled by the olfactory interests of the animals at the other end of the leash. Ever put on perfume or aftershave, your very favorite, and let your dog sniff it? I just dabbed on my wrist some Chanel No. 5, a true classic of jasmine and other floral sweetnesses, and asked my dogs to sniff it. Luke and Lassie sniffed, turned their heads and stomachs, and backed up. Tulip and Pip insisted on ignoring my wrist and sniffed to see if there was food in my fist. Finally satisfied that there was no treat there, they sniffed my wrist and wrinkled their noses. If they could, I suspect that they'd have had me outside under the hose, scrubbing off that disgusting smear of perfume while muttering some doggy version of, "Don't blame me for this bath. I didn't grind this disgusting stuff all over your body." It makes sense that we'd be attracted to different types of smells. Omnivores like our early humanoid primate ancestors were always seeking out plump, juicy fruits, and that legacy drives our attraction to fruity and flowery smells. Dogs are hunters and scavengers, attracted to, rather than repelled by, the scent of ripe carcasses. In the big scheme of things, one attraction makes no more sense than the other. When you think about it, soaking in plant genitalia or whale goo really isn't inherently any more sensible than rolling in cow pies. That perspective helps me a bit when I'm not quick enough to stop one of my dogs from her blissful wallow in some wretched, stinking mess. But given the power of smell to attract, or in this case, to repel, it frankly doesn't help enough. The next time Tulip comes home smiling and stinking to high heaven of fox feces, I think I'm going to soak her in a bucket of Chanel No. 5. That'll teach her.